Welcome to Why So Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. Coming up on today's program, in this week's reinvention story, you'll meet a couple in Dayton's Five Oaks neighborhood who have turned their backyard into an agricultural oasis. We'll talk with Jim Gross of Public Health Dayton and Montgomery County about their new non-smoking policy for employees, and Bill Felker has this week's look at the living world around us. All that and more. Up first, the state's unemployment rate dropped in the last month and is now below the national average, but State House correspondent Karen Castle reports not everyone is looking at the jobs numbers in the same way.
The state's jobless rate for February was 6.5%, a drop from January's 6.9%, and at its lowest rate since June 2008. Angela Therese with the state's Job and Family Services Agency says it's hard to read too much into one month's data.
But the news in February was good. I mean, the unemployment rate was down. Our experts believe that the economy is slowly strengthening and that it will continue to grow.
But a progressive-leaning research group says they're looking at other data that shows Ohio lost 4,600 jobs between January and February. Hannah Halbert is with Policy Matters Ohio.
Over the last 12 months, Ohio jobs have increased by only 1%, and that's slightly below the national average performance of 1.6%.
The Kasich administration is also noting a federal labor report that ranked Ohio second in the country in job growth in January, which shows there is a lot of data on employment and also many ways to interpret it. Karen Kassler at the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau.
Miami County Health Commissioner Chris Cook has agreed to become the new CEO of Springfield's Rocking Horse Center. WISO's Wayne Baker reports the center's board of directors announced Wednesday that Cook will start his new position on April 21st.
Cook is a lifelong resident of Clark County and a graduate of Kenton Ridge High School and Wright State University. He's held several key public health positions in Miami County and has served as a commissioner since 2011. Rocking Horse Board President Rob Baker says the center needed strong leadership after a tough year. The Rocking Horse Board parted ways with founder Dr. James Duffy, whose ouster drew several protests from parents and employees. Baker says Cook was selected from a pool of eight finalists because of his communication skills and ability to run a federally qualified health care center.
He took over as health commissioner there in Miami County. That organization had suffered some trauma, kind of similar to what we've had, and he was able to rally the troops and refocus their attention to the mission there of public health in Miami County, and has just done a magnificent job bringing them along.
Cook will be taking over for Dana Engel, who left the center last year for another job. Wayne Baker, WYSO.
On Tuesday night, the Brookville City Council put two zoning ordinance votes on hold. Approval of those zoning changes would have brought the plan to move the Montgomery County Fairgrounds to Brookville a little bit closer. Instead, the votes were put on hold until funding for a requested access road on the proposed property can be found. Brookville Mayor Dave Seagrave says the road is needed to ease potential traffic problems that would come with the new fairgrounds. The mayor says Miller Valentine and its partner, the Montgomery County Agricultural Society, are pulling those funds together. Estimated costs for the road are roughly $850,000. Brookville City Council will reconvene on the matter in 2 weeks. Coming up later in the program, this week's reinvention story. Stay tuned for that. Up next, for the most part, winter weather seems to have given away to occasional warmth and sunshine, and that has many people looking ahead to summer. But as Ohio Public Radio's Karen Kassler reports for us again, for some, that's not about putting together summer vacation plans, but about considering how they're going to get basic needs met during those months away from school.
Over 840,000 school-aged children, 44% of those enrolled in public and private schools around Ohio, are eligible for a free or reduced-price school lunch or breakfast program. Not all of them get free or lower-priced food at school, but Lisa Hamler-Fugit with the Ohio Association of Food Banks says in some parts of the state, nearly all the kids are in those school food programs.
We've got a lot of districts, especially at the elementary level, that where nearly 7 out of 10 are currently receiving a free or reduced-priced meal.
But last year, when school was out for summer, only about 1 in 10 of those kids got the breakfasts or lunches they received during the school year from a summer food service site. Activists are now working on the reasons why 90% of kids who could get that free food in the summer aren't getting it. Hamler Fugit says Ohio's food pantries and soup kitchens served over 850,000 children last summer.
If we don't have a summer program in those communities, then they're turning to the Emergency Food Assistance Network, and we don't have it.
Marion's food service program is considered a success. Last year's program was set up at 16 different sites and served 1,200 kids a day. That's about 35% of the eligible children, and that number was double the previous year's. Winnie Brewer with the Marion City School says this year's challenge is to get more community partnerships for activities, which are not paid for by federal dollars, and to make sure those kids who are eligible for summer food programs know about them.
Sometimes they think, oh, you know, that's just for whatever, you know, maybe a lower income or whatever, but it's not. So when they see different opportunities there and they see activities going on, then it becomes okay to go to these, especially for the older teens.
But in some counties, 35% is not a successful number because there are so many children to reach. Over 90% of kids in Jackson County are eligible for school food programs. Susan Rogers directs RSVP of the Ohio Valley, which covers Jackson and seven other counties with widespread poverty and serious transportation challenges. There's no public transit, and many families have only one car. Last year, the summer food program served 1,500 kids in two of those counties and a few in a third county. This year, they're adding a fourth county with food service sites, and they're continuing to deliver hundreds of boxes of a week's worth of food to churches, Grange halls, and other places that are more accessible to rural families who can't always get to the same place every day. And Rogers says they've been running into another obstacle.
We have a lot of folks that say, it's kind of charity, and I really don't want that charity, and helping them to understand that, you know, this is something that is provided for the benefit of the kids, and it's not that handout. I think they're afraid that it'll be seen that they can't take care of their kids.
On the opposite end of the economic scale is Medina County. Sandy Calvert is with the two-person crew that comprises Feeding Medina County, which boasts 300 volunteers, one of whom is her husband, former Republican State Representative Chuck Calvert. Calvert says her group is serving 460 kids a week at 12 elementary schools with bags of food sent home on Friday afternoons. Calvert says Medina County has the largest gap between the top and bottom level income earners. And she says residents are realizing that.
So that stigma isn't there. We've really tried to educate people that it is their friends and neighbors who have found themselves in either a situational poverty issue or that it isn't always just generational.
Calvert says last year she set up a summer food program with local funding to avoid some of the federal government's rules, which she found overwhelming. But activists say they need to start setting up those programs, with the federal government's help or not, now, since many counties have only a single or a few summer food service sites. And 13 counties in Ohio, some of them among the state's poorest, don't have a single summer food service program. Karen Kassler at the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau.
You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning. Smokers need not apply. That's part of the new policy Public Health Dayton and Montgomery County handed down in January. The move is an effort to increase employee health and reduce health care costs. And to find out more, I spoke with Health Commissioner Jim Gross.
If you take a look at tobacco and its impact across the nation, the federal government estimates that almost a 500,000 people die prematurely from tobacco products or exposure to tobacco smoke in the United States each year. And from an economic standpoint, it costs for health services due to tobacco about $100 billion a year. And then there's almost another $100 billion due to lost productivity in the work sector. So the use of tobacco has a profound impact on United States citizens in more ways than one. If you look at Montgomery County, the impact here is enormous as well. And in Montgomery County, where we have approximately 5,500 deaths each year, it is thought that tobacco is responsible in one way or another for probably over 1,000 of those deaths. So, you know, a little over 20% or so of the deaths here in Montgomery County can be attributed to tobacco use or exposure to smoke. So with regard to tobacco, both on health and productivity is really why we went forward with the policy. And specifically, the policy has really three main objectives. One is to help create a healthier workforce. Number two is to save taxpayers money. And a recent study by an Ohio State researcher showed that a tobacco user has an additional $6,000 cost per individual for the employer as opposed to someone who does not smoke. And then thirdly, as the public health organization in Montgomery County, we wanted to show leadership, and hopefully other entities, both private and public, will follow our lead. The private sector has been involved with policies involving tobacco for some time, but the public sector has lagged behind. Typically, organizations really connect policies like this with their health insurance, either by having an incentive or a disincentive with regard to tobacco. We did a little bit differently here at Public Health in Montgomery County. We didn't want to tie it to the health insurance because we don't have total control over health insurance. We're connected to Montgomery County overall. So as the public health agency, we're a little bit different, so we did things a little bit differently here.
Let's talk about specifics of the policy, the first being with regard to new hires with public health.
That's correct. And the policy really pertains to both nicotine and tobacco because there's various products now on the market that may not be necessarily tobacco but are related to nicotine. And anyone who wants to be employed here at Public Health for the first time will be asked whether or not they are a nicotine or tobacco user, and if indeed they are, they will not be considered for employment. And anyone who is employed here at Public Health after January 1 of 2014 also cannot use nicotine or tobacco, not only just when they're at work, but at any time. So they shall be non-users, anyone who is employed here after January 1.
You also have a policy in place if a suspected new employee is using tobacco or nicotine.
That's correct. If we suspect that a new employee, that would be an employee who stated that they were a non-user, if we find out that after they are employed that they are a user, they will most likely be terminated. We do not think that this would be an infraction that we would want to go through progressive discipline. Rather, we believe that it's a serious enough violation that we would move for termination by just verifying that the individual was a tobacco user. Now, they would be subject to mandatory testing, so we wouldn't just do it based on some information that we had. We would want some laboratory results to prove that they are a tobacco or nicotine user.
And it's my understanding that you're giving current employees a little bit of time to catch up with this policy.
That's correct. Current employees, there are different provisions for them as opposed to the new employees. The current employees, one of the provisions is that they can no longer use nicotine or tobacco products during paid breaks or while they are on administrative leave. An example of administrative leave would be if an individual is going to, let's say, Columbus for a meeting. They shall not use tobacco products while they are going to the meeting and being paid by the taxpayers of Montgomery County. We thought that it was important to allow a grace period and not simply require compliance with that provision on January the 1st. So we gave our employees a 90-day period of time to comply with that new provision, and that compliance will be then required as of April the 1st.
How far up the ladder does this policy extend?
Well, the policy applies to our employees and our contractors, our program contractors, and actually to the Board of Health. And there are additional provisions other than just the provision for paid breaks and administrative leave. For example, the Board of Health members, and there are 9 Board of Health members, and the executive team, along with some special classifications of employees. Those include any of our employees who carry out tobacco cessation classes, those who work as asbestos inspectors, and our inspectors also who would do Ohio smoke-free inspections in our restaurants and bars. All of those individuals shall be nicotine and tobacco free within 1 year. So there are special requirements for those individuals as well, and we will give them a 1 year period to comply with that law. But I'll tell you, Jerry, that you know I don't think that there are any tobacco or nicotine users in that group, so it will not really pose an extra burden on those individuals. There's also a provision in the policy that applies to individuals who want to be promoted. We think it's important that the new leaders in the organization also become nicotine or tobacco-free over time, or at least make a really strong effort to do so. So anyone who wants to be promoted here at Public Health Dayton Montgomery County must go through tobacco cessation every 6 months. Now, if they would happen to kick the habit, so to speak, you know, after their first set of classes, then that's terrific. But if they are unsuccessful in becoming nicotine tobacco free after their first class, they need to do it every 6 months. We try to make it as convenient for our individuals here as possible. They can attend our own tobacco cessation classes, do so at no cost, and also go through those classes during their work time. And I'm happy to report that we estimate that approximately 25% of our employees who we believe, you know, may be smokers attended the first class. So we're excited about that. We thought that was a good turnout, and we hopefully will get that kind of support going forward.
What was the initial response from employees?
The initial response, while, you know, I believe it's realistic to think that some were probably not thrilled over the policy, I really only received a message from one employee who really wanted to challenge a little bit the policy, and we certainly welcome, you know, any sort of concerns employees have. So it wasn't surprising to us that we received some concerns, but quite frankly, I personally did not hear from as many people as I thought that I would. It was also interesting to me that I heard from some of our supervisors that some of the smokers on staff actually thanked us for the policy because it gave them extra incentive to actually go through tobacco cessation. Now, I don't know whether or not those individuals were in the first class that we held, and I don't know if they were successful, but I thought that that was a really positive outlook by some of our employees to actually say, you know, thanks a lot, this is going to spur me on to hopefully kick the habit, which they wanted to do for some time.
You mentioned policies like these trending in within private organizations. Do you expect that trend to continue in public organizations, healthcare specifically? And is this kind of a unique approach for public institutions?
Well, we certainly hope so. One of our main objectives was to set a good example, you know, in our community, and hopefully people will follow our lead. I will tell you that we do know that there are other public sector employers right now that are very interested in our policy and, in fact, may be moving forward with some provisions on their own. Now, obviously, our situation is very unique because of being the public health leader in the community, but some of the other public sector employers, but you know, both with regard to governmental organizations and also some of our public schools, may be also moving forward in this direction. You know, the private sector, Jerry, has been doing this for some time, but the public sector has lagged behind. So we certainly hope what we've done here in Montgomery County will help set the tone for others.
Any possible legal challenges to the new policy?
We were very careful with regard to how we approached the policy, and before we really got through a first draft of the policy, we engaged a local law firm here in Dayton who specializes in public sector employment, and to make sure that we did everything that we could do to avoid you know, any sort of challenges. You can't do anything really to guarantee that you won't be challenged, but we certainly wanted to minimize anything, you know, any potential legal action taken because of the policy. And I'm happy to report that to date we have not heard from anyone regarding any sort of legal challenges. You know, we wanted to make sure that we didn't misstep with regard to this policy that would end up maybe costing taxpayers money. We wanted to save taxpayers dollars in this effort and not lose money.
Jim, and I guess my final question, have you heard concerns over whether this health initiative could go further and you would expect employees to, say, lose weight, take fitness classes, or change dietary habits, or maybe even curb other use like alcohol?
Yes, we did. We certainly got comments to that effect, and which was to be expected. And in fact, the Board of Health, when they passed the tobacco policy, they also passed a policy that pertains only to one individual in the organization, and that's to the health commissioner. And it did have to do with body weight, and it was a policy that the health commissioner needs to exhibit a body weight that is really consistent with the message that we want to send out in the community. And this organization has been advocating for healthy lifestyles for many years, and the policy then hopefully would in a way, you know, force the health commissioner in his or her role as they are out in the community to hopefully motivate others to take healthy lifestyles. But there was absolutely no discussion, and there's been no discussion since, about doing anything with regard to body weight or exercise or anything regarding other healthy lifestyles with regard to staff. And I really don't see that happening in the future, at least as far as we can see right now.
Jim Gross, Health Commissioner with Public Health, Dayton and Montgomery County. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you, Jerry. Appreciate the opportunity.
Non-smoking single female, six single man. Must have good sense of humor and a pension plan.
Coming up next on WISO Weekend, WISO's Reinvention Stories. When Tad Erickson and John Futh moved to Five Oaks in 2011, they were taking a leap of faith. They believed the house they purchased on Roe Avenue was in good condition, but they couldn't be sure. They bought it online. Tad begins their story.
Well, we lived on the West Coast in Long Beach, Washington, and we just kind of got on the internet because we got tired of renting and decided it would be better to buy. And Dayton came up, and we pretty much bought the house sight unseen, drove 4,000 miles, did not know anybody, not a soul. Boy, I was in a cold sweat for 4 days driving here because we just didn't know what we were getting ourselves into, and we really lucked out. When we pulled up, there was a lot of people. All our neighbors came out, said hello, and it was really nice.
And they treated us like we were one of the family.
In better days, Five Oaks was a thriving place for families. A half-mile square block of some 2,000 residential homes with large yards where neighbors could gather and children could play. But rising crime rates in the 80s and 90s pushed many people behind locked doors. John calls their section of Roe Avenue a diamond in the rough.
A block west of us and probably a block to the north and not even a block at the end of our street to the south of us is all places that I wouldn't walk during the dark.
I think the neighborhood is being a lot more vigilant with keeping an eye out for each other, and people are taking a lot more pride in their property and where they live. So that's a really good plus.
Tad and John are working with their neighbors to help Five Oaks thrive again, but they've got their own challenges. Both men are living with AIDS.
It's been hit and miss. John's my third partner. It seems every 10 years I kind of go through a new one. You know, I lost my first one in 90 and my other one in 98. And then John and I have been together since then. The 80s were pretty scary, but I'm fit, and my doctor, for the first time in my life, says, hey, you need to, you know, plan on what you're going to be doing when you're 80, because you're going to die an old man.
John has more serious health issues and has been hospitalized several times since we met last summer.
My liver is kind of on the fritz because of all the meds and stuff that I take. It's killing my liver.
But John says he and Tad are getting the care they need in Dayton among friends, neighbors, and places like AIDS Resource Center Ohio. Together, they've also cultivated a healthier lifestyle, one that begins right in their own backyard.
And then we got the big garden here, and this is where we got our tomatoes and okra, and we had beans and a lot of squash.
Most of the food Tad and John eat is food they've grown. The gardens they started after moving here flourish during the summer months.
It's a bad thing for the dog because she's running out of room. We can everything and freeze everything, so we try to live as much off the grid as we can.
The leap of faith Tad Erickson and John Futh took almost 3 years ago has given them a place they call home, a community they call family, and now a new direction in their lives.
And I think it's time to start teaching some other people with AIDS how to be self-sufficient and live off the grid, and they need to start thinking about how they're going to plan on their future, because they ain't going to die, you know?
To see a short film about Tad Erickson and John Futh, visit our website at wyso.org. Major funding for the second season of Reinvention Stories comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, with support from Wright State University, Celia Fund, and the Yellow Springs Community Foundation and Antioch College. You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning. Now, to offer some clarity to the living world around us, here's our own Bill Felker.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the sixth and final week of early spring. March 5th was the first day of Lent. And on that date, practicing Christians began a 6.5-week vigil for Easter. The Lenten landscape always takes me back to my childhood and to the gray, cold days of waiting for the season to be over. It brings on reminiscence that not only crosses the boundaries of years and snow and the space between winter and spring, but also the boundaries of my spiritual or religious upbringing and my rebellion and my reconciliation. When I was a boy growing up in Wisconsin, the land gave up very little before Easter. The winters were always long, and I was always restless and impatient for them to end. Snow still covered the ground most of the time in Lent, and there were few signs of the spring to come. And I remember the purple vestments of the priest on Sundays, the gloomy hymns of Holy Week, and all the darkness of prelude to the crucifixion. In every place or situation, the holographic presence of association has the ability to transform the immediate earth around me into the earth of the past. It seems that these imprints are indelible, as they used to tell me in catechism class, and cognitive measures often fail to counteract the sense of distant seasons. Thinking doesn't help so much. But if I pay attention, I can refashion time with what's happening now. Dandelions and snow crocus and snowdrops in bloom. Open pussy willows, maples in flower, nettles tall enough for greens, robin and cardinal song before dawn. Red-winged blackbirds whistling their mating territories in the swamp. The first cabbage butterflies hatching in the afternoon. The rising Christ of spring. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the very first week of middle spring. In the meantime, remake the world. You have all the materials right around you. Thursday noons, between March 20th and April 24th, I will be the moderator of a seminar at the University of Dayton entitled The Inner Landscape. And these will be discussions about the almanac readings on WISO. For more information, call the Special Programs Office at the University of Dayton, 937-229-2605.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at WISO.org.
That's it for this week's edition of WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at WYSO.org, a community service of Antioch College for the Miami Valley and beyond. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for listening, and thanks to all our guests. Coming up next on WYSO, The Book Nook.